12:12 on WGN Wintrust Business Lunchtime. This is John Williams. Pete Zimmerman's our producer. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Last couple of days, the NASDAQ and the Dow have been fighting. Today, the Dow's up 313 points as I speak. The NASDAQ is off 52. I don't know if that's all that strange, but the markets haven't been in alignment, in part because on days where it seems like the tech sector does well, the other stocks don't, and then sometimes it's the reverse of that. Today, you've got the Dow up 300, IBM doing well, oil is high, and Orion was telling you a moment ago about how strong gold is. Highest price in 9 years. Here's John Najarian to get us started on the Wintrust Business Lunch today for MarketRebellion.com. Hi, John. Welcome back. So what are you reading in the tea leaves of the markets today?
Well, I think Orion and you both nailed it. There's some rotation into some commodity-related stocks, oil and gold. Silver I'd throw in there, too, because silver has kind of quietly gone from 17 an ounce to 18 to 19 and then to $20 an ounce. So that's quite a move for silver. We haven't seen a move like that in any of the metals for quite a while. I mean, the fact that, as you say, we're pushing up against very stratospheric levels for gold is not so surprising, but silver to make such a dramatic move is kind of surprising. So it's up another 6% today, the Silver Trust, SLV, for those that trade ETFs on metals and things like that, and volume in it is just double normal volume already today.
I want to read you something that CNBC's Jim Cramer said on his show. He said yesterday that he's never seen anything like the big moves for the large cap tech companies that have pushed the NASDAQ to record highs. Somebody mentioned earlier, is NASDAQ now positive for the year? I think it is. He believes this situation is different than the tech bubble of the late 1990s. Insanity does not mean it's over. Insanity just means, can we please just stop comparing it to 1999, he said, because in 1999, a lot of really bad companies gained a lot of market cap. Here, a lot of unbelievably great companies are gaining market cap at a pace that you've got to give them a speeding ticket. I guess the bottom line is not that this is bad, but that it's amazing how evidently opportune this market is for that sector.
Yeah, you really couldn't. I mean, there are several things about COVID and the shutdowns and so forth that have been either hugely beneficial or hugely detrimental. I mean, obviously, you couldn't have created a better way to accentuate the wage gap, the wealth gap, and all of that sort of thing than to take everybody out of the economy that is working either a gig job like an Uber or is working at fast foods where it's face-to-face, and thus, you know, those were virtually shut down for most of the last 3 months. And on the other hand, if you're somebody that doesn't depend on that face-to-face, you really couldn't see a better runway for those stocks than for Apple, than for Amazon, than for even Facebook. I mean, when you have billions of people on the platform, yesterday Disney announced that, and they're the largest buyer of ads on Facebook. Yesterday they announced that they were giving a moratorium on that. They didn't say we're leaving forever, but they said, you know, we're going to give it a rest. We're part of the protest. Stock rallied. I mean, your biggest customer steps away from you and the stock rallies. And one of the reasons, John, is because, okay, who else can deliver you billions of people and geo-fence those people around the area that you want to reach? Yeah. So, you know, these stocks, you know, that many of us would, you know, there's the COVID stocks that people have to be face-to-face, which is anything in hospitality. And then there's tech, which is virtually no face-to-face. And they're benefiting from that lack of personal communication, if you will, or the lack of certainly being in the same room with another person.
John Najarian from Market Rebellion. When we come back, let's talk about the status of the extra $600 in unemployment benefits and the status of a $1,200 stimulus check or a $6,000 one for families, John. John Najarian's on a phone line. We're talking about the markets. John, let's just continue now. A lot of attention this week on the last of the $600 supplemental unemployment benefits checks. What are you hearing or guessing is going to happen to that?
I hope I'm wrong, but I don't think anything happens this week. This is the first day that they're discussing it, supposedly, between Republicans, represented by not Mitch McConnell, but by Steve Mnuchin and House Leader Pelosi. I am probably, like many of your listeners, John, frustrated that, A, it takes till the last minute before they do something, and the they is everybody in government. I don't know why this takes so long for them to get together and do this. But I don't think anything will really happen this week, per se, but I think by the end of next week they will. And I don't know why you need to introduce either the volatility or the uncertainty of that into the markets, or not just, I'm not worried about the market per se, but into individuals' lives that are dependent right now when the markets are shut down, when the businesses are forced to close or stay at a capacity that doesn't allow them to return back to work. I don't know why you'd want to prolong that. I would think you'd want to address it as quickly as possible rather than at the last minute. That doesn't seem like the way our government works, though.
No.
So it seems that next week, perhaps, is when we'll hear something. But I don't anticipate anything this week.
Well, and I know the frustration is not that this is some academic issue we're debating. This is families' lives. We're talking about groceries and gas here. And a couple of the issues that the sides have not come to an agreement on are, what's the value of that check? Is it $1,200? Is it more or less? Is it $6,000 for a family, which is one option and could be more generous? And then the other issue is the threshold. So previously it was $75,000 for individuals and $99,000 for families. I think Mitch McConnell wants to lower that down to $40,000 to qualify, or at least you would see your benefits start to drop off with a stimulus check. Your thoughts on some of those sort of data points?
I'm not as concerned about the data points. If indeed, because you would think by now, Jonathan, that we would see exactly, percentage-wise, who got the money and how effective it was zip code by zip code across the country. Obviously, the extra $600 a month that we talk about a lot, or per week rather, that is a godsend for everybody, but it's a godsend not for you and me, thankfully, but it's a godsend for anybody outside of those major cities like New York and San Francisco that have such high costs for them to, which is why it was put in the first place, by the way, the extra $600. Because I think parts of the country, Nebraska, probably downstate Illinois, and hundreds of other areas, this has actually benefited the recipients in a big way. Because that's why their retail spending has gone up so much, even during a shutdown, because they're making more staying at home. And again, this is not me demonizing those people. They have no choice. They have to stay home. So the government that mandated that has to do something about it. And this is one of the ways they've addressed it. If they end up jockeying the numbers around a little bit to make it more effective for those that are on the lower scale, then I think they should give them a little more money and a little less on the upper scale.
Yeah, I understand how you might have a sort of graduated schedules for families, depending on where they live or what they previously earned. I will say this, when this subject generally came up on our other show that we do from 9 to noon here, after Bob Surratt's show, I sit in this chair, and I was hearing from individuals who said, I take offense to the idea that I would rather not be working and just collect the check. So many people who are not making more money or are making more money with the extra $600 want to go to work. And they want to have benefits, and they want to have their job. That's a big part of their life, their family, their identity. I also want to say this. Forbes had a piece earlier this year. It was an op-ed, as I recall. Maybe it was just some opinion column by somebody. And they said, to your point, John, if we were going to be completely fair about it, the $600 or the $1,200 would be prorated depending on, as you said, the cost of living where you are. So in San Francisco, you really need 12 and 6. But in Pekin, Illinois, where the cost of living is so much lower, if you were going to be treated just like people in San Francisco get treated, then you would get maybe $800 and $400 because the cost of living is so much less. If they do that, there will be no end of hell to pay. I can just promise you that while that makes economic sense, macroeconomic sense, that would not be a very popular opinion to fly out there.
No, you're right. And yet it is the exact same as saying in New York City they have a density issue, obviously, because of how New York City, in particular the island of Manhattan, is constructed. So there are people on top of people, which to a large extent is why they had the highest death rates in the country from COVID, not just because flights were coming in from China as well as Europe with people carrying the disease, perhaps, but also because people are on top of people. Having the same restrictions in New York as you might put in Kansas or any place else is also ludicrous. And yet, you know, that's the bill of goods that we're being sold, John.
Well,
so I agree with you. People are unlikely to be very supportive of getting less in Piatone than they get in New York City. And yet they're going to push this idea that we should have the same sort of shutdowns and so forth in Piatone again versus New York City, given the density issue is so much different. It should obviously be different in terms of how people go about their business and returning to work.
I understand that point, and I think you could make it just with Cook County and Chicago versus downstate Illinois. They wanted to open up.
Sure.
Some of those counties have had less than 10 cases, let alone deaths, where that is in some neighborhoods in the Chicago area. Let me just bounce one other idea off of you. Fundstrat's Thomas Lee is looking for the stock market to bang out, quote, significant new highs by the end of the year with the onset of a vaccine coming up. He just thinks there's a lot of, I'm reading from MarketWatch.com, but there's a lot of cash on the side. And if we decide that we do have a viable vaccine, he sees the market doing even better than it is now. Do you think that will happen?
I do. And Tom is a friend, and we've had him on our roundtables many times. And I think he's been spot on. His work at Fundstrat, if you either follow him on Twitter, that's his handle, Fundstrat, F-U-N-D, Strat. You can see the work is just very concise and precise that they do about which areas of the country are seeing pickups in COVID, which are rolling back over in a good way, back down, and virtually all of them, California, Florida, Texas, Georgia, are rolling back over in terms of the metrics that he is looking at. And as he says, if we get that vaccine or a series of vaccines and or boosters into the fall, this market would rock.
John Najarian is the founder of MarketRebellion.com, the financial news education and subscription site, MarketRebellion.com. Thanks for your time again, John.
Always. Thank you, John.
12:30. This is WGN. An update on what's happening at Loyola University with the cutbacks at some colleges and also what's going on next in the food and restaurant sector, the hospitality sector. Bruce Faber joins us. As much as you like to think about going back to restaurants or bars, or maybe stepping back a little bit in Chicago starting on Friday, imagine the conundrum for the people that have to hire the employees or lay them off or then rehire them and retrain them. He is a consultant in that field, and he joins us on WGN. Bruce, thanks for joining us. How are you today?
I'm doing great, John. Thank you for having me.
You are the owner of EHS Hospitalities, Illinois and Wisconsin branches. EHSHospitality.com is the site. So is that what you do, though? You work with restaurants in hiring and training employees?
That's all we do. For 28 years, working with restaurants, hotels, resorts, any company that has food service.
And I suppose, well, that's its own set of challenges. Now you have to teach or train or ensure that the employees buy into the program that says not only are we going to get the food out there hot with a smile, but we're going to have to do so in a way that is safe. And if we're lax about it, then the whole house of cards crumbles, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
So what are some tips, or how are you working with restaurant groups? What are they telling you? How amenable are employees to those ideas?
Well, obviously the restaurant groups themselves have to stay open. And right now with the COVID, business is down, depending on the operation, anywhere from 25, 30, 40, 50% or more. So as they're working with their team and slowly bringing back staff at all levels, from managers who were furloughed all the way to the servers and line cooks and everyone else, we're going through a whole new training process. And everyone, you know, wants to stay safe, wants to remain safe, want to create that environment where when the customers come in, they feel safe. So it's a whole new level of training that is out there. And, you know, obviously, as we all know, this Friday, we're going to go back to phase three in some senses. But right now, everyone is open. They're excited to be back to work, and they really want to take care of the customers in the safest way they can.
So is it wear gloves and wear a mask? Okay, there, the training thing is over. What did I miss?
Oh, it's so much more than that. So not only from the business standpoint, bringing in plexiglass and the masks, the gloves, the sanitizer, but also retraining the staff on how to interact with the customer, because obviously they can't see their smiles, and the customer may not be as comfortable as they normally are mm-hmm. when they're in the restaurant. So that first impression, when the guest first walks up to the door, that host smiling in his or her mask, the eye contact, the attention, and really creating that safe environment. So as they're walking the guest to the table, seating them, if they're using menus, showing that they're clean, if they have a touch screen, showing that, and really having all of the different staff members stop by the table at some point in time just to welcome them back, have that big smile, and create that nice, comfortable atmosphere.
That smile as it is under the mask, but maybe I'll see it, I'll hear it, I'll appreciate it. And yet some of the customers won't abide by the rules that you're asking them to. So how do you empower the staff, or what do you tell the staff to do about that?
Well, basically, you just go through what you were retraining them to do, to make sure that, you know, they are providing that safe experience, that they're following all the guidelines, that they're, as always, listening to the customer. And, you know, if the customer is not comfortable with something, you know, listen to what he or she has to say. If there's something we can do to accommodate them, whether it be they don't want silverware that's open on the table, or, you know, maybe they're not comfortable with the fact that the menu has fingerprints on it, that's fine. So it's really, you know, listening, taking that extra time, and doing whatever it takes to make sure that the customer is happy and feels safe.
Is there a universal answer to this, though? If the customer is not abiding by the rules of the restaurant, they're not wearing their mask in the common area, or whatever the rule is, what do you do? Do you kick them out? How do you manage that situation?
Yeah, I think every operation has their own set of rules, and the key is how you communicate that to the customer. So if your restaurant, you're requiring that even the guests wear masks while they're walking from the front host stand to the table, you just have to friendly remind them. Oftentimes they may forget, so you want to make sure that you have masks available for them. Also let them know that when they are seated, please feel free to take off your mask, enjoy your experience. Our server and service assistants and manager and everyone else will be wearing their masks. But take it off. So it's really just a friendly reminder, because every operation you go into, it's different, and how you enforce it is different. But the key is just really keeping that engagement with the customer and making sure that, you know, you're not telling them what to do. You just want them to kind of follow the policies and procedures of your organization.
Well, if you're a restaurant owner, you need to rethink stuff like this. EHSHospitality.com, or a manager for that matter, EHSHospitality.com. Bruce Faber, thanks for joining us today, Bruce. We'll visit again.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, John.
Have a good day. It's 12:41. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute. Steve Bertrand's away this week. David Jennings has it.
Wind the clock. This is the Wintrust Business Minute, your daily roundup of Chicago area business news. Small gas engine maker Briggs & Stratton has filed for Chapter 11. KPS Capital Partners is planning to acquire all the company's assets for $550 million. Founded in Milwaukee, Briggs & Stratton was the world's biggest maker of small gasoline engines. Loyola University Chicago plans on cutting employees, contributions to retirement accounts, and expenses in some areas to close a $50 million budget gap, all triggered by the COVID-19 pandemic. Potbelly, known nationally for the sandwich shops, says Robert Wright will become its new president and CEO, succeeding Alan Johnson. Wright comes to Potbelly's from Wendy's, where he was an executive vice president and chief operations officer. That's the Wintrust Business Minute. I'm David Jennings.
Thank you, David. Jordan Burnfield, what have you got for us?
Well, I've got numbers for you. The Dow right now up 302 points, while the NASDAQ is down 28. But the S&P 500, that's up 20.
Other commodities, Orion Samuelson's looking at. What have you got, O?
Well, we're looking at commodity prices that are up and down today, depending on the commodity. But traders are reacting to the crop condition reports that were shared yesterday by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. 69% of the nation's U.S. corn crop rated good to excellent. Illinois, 63%, Indiana, 59%, Iowa, 80%, but Wisconsin rated 81% good to excellent. Soybeans, 69% of the nation's soybean crop rated good to excellent, with Illinois, 67%, Indiana, 60%, Iowa, 74%, and Wisconsin, again, the garden spot of the Midwest, 83% of the soybean crop rated good to excellent. And some more purchases by China today, and they have been pretty active. This is the second straight day that China booked a small purchase of U.S. soybeans. The sales, part of a recent string of deals with China, private exporters reported to the USDA that China bought 126,000 tons of soybeans, and the USDA also reported sales of 180,000 tons of soybeans and 27,880 tons of corn to unknown destinations. In South America, the Bayer Company has launched carbon capture program for farmers in Brazil and in the United States. They will pay farmers for capturing carbon in cropland soils, making it the largest agriculture company to seek to capitalize on environmental initiatives. The company will seek to enroll about 1,200 row crop farmers in the Bayer Carbon Initiative in the first season, with a goal to scale up in upcoming seasons and ultimately expand to other countries. Bayer is working with other partners, including Brazil's Embrapa, the government's crop research agency, to build a market for trading the carbon credits created to aid in the atmospheric conditions here in the United States as well as other countries in the world. And that's Ag Biz. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Amy Guth covers the business scene for us on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Hi again, Amy.
Hi, John. How are you today?
I'm doing well. I'm looking at a number of stories. Some of them seem to be kind of trivial, but then again, it's how we live. Let's start with, if you don't mind, inflatable pools, water slides, because we've talked about the whole toy sector, puzzles, bicycles, gym equipment for your home. They are continuing to do well, aren't they?
That's exactly right. And, you know, I had that same thought. I thought, well, that's not big, hard-hitting stuff. But indeed, you know what? People are living more from their homes than ever. And so it stands to reason that we would see that reflected in our shopping habits. And indeed we have in the toy sector. When we're thinking about outside kind of toys like blow-up pools and slides and sprinklers and slip-and-slides, if they even still make those, things like that, right? So what we saw is in March, that grew 16%. February, 22%, May, up 37%, and then in June, 19%. So in talking with people from the industry, they're going, you know, this is really, really out of normal. You know, normally we're up maybe 3 or 4%. This is very, very unusual, but that makes perfect sense. Maybe kids aren't out of the public pool. They're not going to camp, things like that. So parents are thinking, well, what can I do to still, you know, help my kid play and burn off some of that energy and have a nice summer? And that's that answer. So that kind of game, especially arts and crafts stuff, not just outside things, but other kind of things. The only group that didn't, or the only part of toys that didn't really see much growth was action figures. It was more about, like, experiential kind of making stuff, having an adventure kind of toys. But that's a really significant growth, especially for May, as people are stepping into summer, up 37%. But then that strong trend continuing in June, too.
Plus, the longer I think you're in, the less interesting TV gets, sports around the corner notwithstanding. Brendan and I played Yahtzee the other night. We haven't done that in a while, although early in the pandemic we were playing board games, kind of went away, you know, watched Tiger Joe or Tiger King. Remember that?
Right.
But
that seems like years ago already.
Doesn't it, though? It's the same pandemic. That's how long this thing has been going on. And since we're not going to, I know you've been following this, too, stadiums, theaters, things like that, Coca-Cola sales are off then, too, right?
Yeah, so if you recall, we talked before about Q1 Coca-Cola numbers, and they were really bad for that very reason you just described. So much of Coke's revenue has to do with people going to movie theaters, people going to, you know, if you think about the dealing Coca-Cola products to, say, a vending machine or a 7-Eleven versus the big tanks of soda fountain, you know, for soda fountains at like movie theaters and ball games and things like that. That's such a big part of their revenue. So that really tanked. We saw that at the end of the first quarter. The second quarter, of course, we've seen that. So their revenue is down 28% in the second quarter. Even though that number is big, it's still an improvement, month in this last month, just as some lockdowns have started to ease in different parts of the world. The only place where we saw volumes up for the quarter was in China, just because there were some restrictions that lifted a little bit earlier, so it lines up with the quarter a little bit differently. But, you know, if you think about the Coca-Cola empire, so they've got, you know, Dasani water, they have some sports drinks, they have all kinds of stuff, right? And they have, of course, some locations called Costa in Europe that were closed, and some of those are reopening. So it's, you know, kind of looking at their big, big portfolio, it's a lot of stuff that all kind of winds together. So their net reported income for the April to June period was $1.8 billion. That's down 32% from the same period a year ago. So that's still, you know, that's still a pretty big hit for them, for that company that seems, you know, kind of unshakable. We think about big companies like that, and you just think, oh, well, they're everywhere. They can weather whatever. A lot of times they can, but that's still such a huge, huge, huge thing. So their revenue fell to $7.2 billion, but they had matched expectations with that. They had changed their forecasting, and shares were up about 2% at the opening bell this morning. But still, you know, that just goes to show you the depth of the hit that so many companies have taken. And, you know, here's a big company like Coke that we think can weather it, and even they took such a big hit. So, it's an easy leap to start wondering, you know, thinking about smaller food brands and how they're faring through all of this.
Yeah, it's also a reminder of how big Coca-Cola is. If in 3 months, in the midst of a pandemic where they're getting crushed, their revenue is $7.2 billion.
That's right.
Talk to me about suburban office vacancies. Is it clear which way we're going to go, where we're going to work, and how that's going to shake out?
It's not totally clear yet, but, you know, in talking with brokerage professionals that are kind of, they're like, you know what, the interest is there. Very similarly, some residential realtors are reporting, hey, some city dwellers are sort of starting to sniff around in the burbs. Similar kind of thing. So what right now is kind of being discussed with a lot of brokerage firms is this idea of giving some options, this kind of like hub and spoke model where, okay, we'll keep the downtown office space, maybe make it a little bit smaller, but we might have something in the north suburbs and maybe something in the south suburbs, maybe something in the west suburbs. So that we, you know, fewer people all together at once, maybe if people start shifting out to the burbs, they still have a place to congregate, they have a little bit of flexibility. We saw office vacancy in the suburbs, it rose to 23% here at the halfway point of the year. So that's up 22, a little over 22% from the first quarter. That's according to Jones Lang LaSalle data. So it's too soon to tell. It's kind of a short move, but nonetheless, we are seeing some vacancy that's looking kind of like we haven't quite seen since about 2018. And really the number to look at is net absorption. And so that's the amount of space that is leased and occupied compared with the prior period. And that number, that was down by 86,000 square feet in the suburbs. Now, part of that, 60,000 of that, is from Oreo maker Mondelez International moving into Fulton Market, so that's a big swath of that. But that's still a kind of a big, you know, when everybody was saying, okay, everybody's kind of dropping anchor in the city and abandoning suburban office space, a lot of suburban landlords were kind of scrambling earlier in this year. And now it seems like interest is there for the tide to turn. So that's something I'm going to be watching really, really closely moving forward to see if both residential and commercial property kind of sees any kind of equilibrium after this big push for downtown, especially the office space.
Business news with Amy Guth. Always a pleasure, Amy. We appreciate your help today.
Thanks so much, John.